Lecture 4, Odysseus Among the Phaeacians.
Hello, and welcome back to Lecture 4. In the previous lecture, we discussed Odysseus's departure from Calypso's island and his arrival at Scheria, where he met and was helped by the Phaeacian princess Nausicaa. We saw how crucial aspects of Odysseus's character, his caution and his skill in rhetoric in particular, were foregrounded from his very first appearance in the Odyssey. In this lecture, we will continue to examine Odysseus's interaction with the Phaeacians, and we will see him begin his own first-person narrative of his adventures from Troy to Calypso's island. As we move into Book 7 of the Odyssey, with Athena's assistance, Odysseus reaches the palace of Nausicaa's parents, Alcinous and Arete, and asks for their help. Athena disguises Odysseus, or rather hides Odysseus, by concealing him in a mist, so that as he moves through the city of the Phaeacians, no one sees him or knows that he is there. Athena herself is disguised as a young girl when she meets Odysseus and leads him to the palace of the Phaeacian queen and king. Athena, in her discussion of Phaeacian society with Odysseus, stresses the importance of Queen Arete. She tells him to beseech the queen rather than the king for aid when he arrives at the palace. This reiterates instructions that Nausicaa had given him at the end of Book 6 when she tells him, "Speak first to my mother and ask her for help." Athena points out that in the society of the Phaeacians, Arete, the queen, is held in reverence almost equal to that of a god, and Athena says that Arete settles disputes even among men, so she's an unusually powerful woman. As we'll see later on, Odysseus remembers this advice and takes it into account in his dealings with the royal couple, Arete and Alcinous. So Odysseus arrives at the palace of the Phaeacian king and queen. He goes inside, and Athena lifts the mist away from him and disappears herself, so that Odysseus is suddenly visible to Queen Arete and King Alcinous. Following the advice of both Athena and Nausicaa, Odysseus does indeed go first to Arete, clasp her knees, and ask her for assistance. She greets him cordially, promises him anything he needs, again, such as a meal, a place to sleep, all of those hallmarks of Xenia, and also promises to give him a ship that will send him home to Ithaca. So Odysseus now has arrived among a people who will help him to reach Ithaca and who will, in fact, give him a ship and an escort to get him there. Not only are they going to help him home, the Phaeacians pride themselves on providing Xenia to any shipwrecked wanderer, and to helping any traveler who needs their help home to his own land. Odysseus will be entertained royally during his stay on the island of Scheria, and Book 8, in fact, of the Odyssey is devoted to the entertainment that is provided for Odysseus by King Alcinous and Queen Arete. This entertainment takes two main forms. Odysseus is treated to a display of athletic games in the first place, and secondly, he is entertained by listening to the songs of the bard Demodocus, who in Book 8 sings three different songs to Odysseus and to the assembled Phaeacians. I want to talk about both of these forms of entertainment, first the athletic games, and second the songs of the bard Demodocus. They're actually interleaved with one another in Book 8. Demodocus sings a song, then there are some athletic games, then Demodocus sings another song, and so on. But I want to separate them for the purposes of discussing them. The athletic games that are performed for Odysseus show us Odysseus in his past aspect of warrior as he was in the Iliad. That may not seem immediately obvious. What do athletic games have to do with Odysseus being a warrior? But the answer to that question is, in the context of Homeric epics, athletic games have everything to do with Odysseus or anyone else being a warrior. Athletics in the Iliad and the Odyssey are, in effect, practice for warfare. These are not athletics engaged in for the purpose of sport, as we might think of sport. They're not something there purely for entertainment or for physical exercise. They are specifically practice for battle. Readers of the Iliad will remember that in Book 23, Achilles' dead friend Patroclus is honored by funeral games, as they're usually described, athletic games held in his honor. There again, those games are practice of the kinds of maneuvers that Patroclus' fellow soldiers would have to perform in the battlefield. Chariot racing, contests in throwing the spear, contests in throwing the discus, running races, jumping contests, all of those things are activities that would be useful on the battlefield and are therefore a stylized kind of practice for battle. So the point of this for Odysseus in Book 8 of the Odyssey is that at one point in the games, a young Phaeacian man named Euryalus says to Odysseus, first invites him to take part in the contests, and when Odysseus refuses, Euryalus says to Odysseus that he does not look like an athlete. He says, I'm not surprised that you don't want to take part in these contests because you do not resemble an athlete. This comment makes Odysseus absolutely furious. The reason, of course, is to say to him, you don't resemble an athlete, equals saying to him, you don't resemble a warrior, you don't look like a fighting man, you don't look like a soldier. And those are words that Odysseus cannot tolerate. In fact, this is so grievous an insult and makes Odysseus so angry that he actually, if anyone is listening carefully, reveals who he is. And that's a very important moment of Odysseus slipping and giving way to his emotion in a way that normally he does not in the Odyssey. He has not, up until this point, told the Phaeacians who he is. Arete had asked him after he had had a meal, after his needs had been attended to. She asked who he was. Odysseus did not answer at that point. He told the story of his captivity on Calypso's island, but he did not say who he himself was. At this point in Book 8, however, when Euryalus says, you don't look like an athlete, Odysseus reacts in two ways. First, he seizes a discus and manages to throw it further than anyone else who's competed so far has thrown it, of course. And secondly, he says to Euryalus and to anyone else who is listening, I was excellent at all forms of warfare, he starts out by saying, but then he focuses in on archery. He says, when we Achaeans were fighting at Troy, I was second best with the bow. Only Philoctetes was better than I was at using the bow and arrow. Now, if anyone is listening carefully, any one of the Phaeacians, and knows about the Trojan War, they would recognize that this must be Odysseus. He's just given away, elliptically, yes, but he has just given away his identity. This is one of the few times, as I said, in the Odyssey, when we see Odysseus giving way to emotion and letting a clue that he had wanted to hold back slip, as he does in this scene. The athletic games, therefore, are not an unqualified success as entertainment for Odysseus, because he ends up being insulted and feeling aggrieved by Euryalus' saying that he doesn't look like a warrior or like an athlete. The songs of the bard Demodocus, the other form of entertainment that was shown in Book 8, are both more successful as entertainment for Odysseus, or at least apparently more successful as entertainment for Odysseus, and also are, again, extremely important thematically for our transition from the earlier part of the Odyssey to Odysseus's own narrative of his wanderings after the fall of Troy. Demodocus sings three different songs, and among the three of them, they reiterate some of the crucial themes of the Trojan War story. So they too, in a way, look back to Odysseus in his role as warrior, Odysseus from the Iliad, rather than Odysseus who is now on his way home to Ithaca. Demodocus's first song tells of a quarrel between Odysseus and Achilles while the Greeks were at Troy. Now, this is the only reference in extant ancient Greek literature to a quarrel between Odysseus and Achilles at Troy. No other author mentions this. It's worth taking a moment to consider what that might mean. There are two possibilities for what that might mean. First, that Homer, the composer of the Odyssey, whoever he was, invented this episode, simply made it up, decided that Demodocus would sing about a quarrel between Odysseus and Achilles for whatever reason the bard wanted to make that up. That's one possibility. Another possibility, of course, is that this quarrel was mentioned elsewhere in other ancient literature, but that other ancient literature has not survived to the present day. This is a problem we confront very frequently in dealing with classical literature. When something is mentioned only once in the literature that we have, does that mean it was really mentioned only once, or does that mean that by the vicissitudes of what has survived and what hasn't, we happen to have only one mention of it? Whichever is true in this case, Demodocus sings about a quarrel between Odysseus and Achilles, and says that Agamemnon rejoiced to see these two, the best of the Achaeans, quarreling with one another, because Agamemnon remembered a prophecy that said Troy would fall soon after the best of the Achaeans quarreled. This reiterates Odysseus's status in terms of what this song is doing in the Odyssey. It reiterates Odysseus's status as second only to Achilles. Achilles was the greatest warrior. Odysseus was the most clever among the Greeks. Aias the Greater, as I've already mentioned, was the second greatest warrior in terms of physical prowess to Achilles. But if Agamemnon looks at Achilles and Odysseus quarreling and thinks of a prophecy about when the best of the Achaeans quarrel, that reiterates the status of Odysseus as one of the two best of the Achaeans. It also, of course, lets Odysseus know and lets us, the audience, know that the Phaeacians are cognizant of the Trojan War story, know about the Trojan War, and know the name Odysseus. Demodocus's second song recounts the love affair between the god Ares, god of war, and Aphrodite, the goddess of sexual passion. Now, at first glance, this may not seem to have a great deal to do with the themes either of the Odyssey or, for that matter, of the Trojan War itself, but I think on closer inspection, in fact, it's very closely connected to the Odyssey and to the Trojan War. Ares and Aphrodite, after all, are having an adulterous love affair. They are not married to one another. Aphrodite, according to the Odyssey, is the wife of Hephaestus. Ares is not married. So on one level, the love affair between Ares and Aphrodite picks up on that subplot or secondary plot of the Odyssey that I've talked about already in earlier lectures, the idea of a wife being unfaithful to her husband in his absence, the fear that Odysseus has that Penelope may not wait for him. On another level, of course, it recalls the cause of the Trojan War in the first place, when Paris and Helen engaged in a similar adulterous love affair at Aphrodite's prompting and thereby caused the Trojan War. One more interesting point about Demodocus's second song is that it is sung after the episode when Euryalus tells Odysseus he doesn't look like an athlete. That is, it's sung out on the playing field, out on the area where the Phaeacian men are engaging in athletic games. There are no women present. The other two songs of Demodocus are both sung in the palace when women, at least Arete and perhaps others, are listening. It's possible that this, by Homeric standards, slightly risque story of Ares and Aphrodite being caught in bed together by the other gods was seen as appropriate for a male audience, but not as appropriate for a female audience. We don't know, of course, what Homer's actual audience would have been, whether male, female, mixed, or what. We simply don't know. Demodocus's third song, which is sung near the end of Book 8, is sung at Odysseus's specific request. The day is ending, the athletic games are over, the Phaeacians and Odysseus with them are eating their evening meal, and Odysseus sends a choice piece of meat to the bard Demodocus, cuts it and sends it across the room to the bard as a gift, and asks the bard to sing a specific song for him. He asks Demodocus to sing about the Trojan horse, the horse, he says, that great Odysseus made, contrived, and he tells Demodocus, if you can sing of it properly, then I will tell everyone that you are one of the greatest bards that ever lived. Demodocus does sing the story of the Trojan horse. He sings it in exquisite detail, and as he sings, Odysseus weeps, listening to Demodocus sing the song of the Trojan horse. Now, Odysseus's weeping at Demodocus's third song is described by the bard with one of the most memorable similes in the Odyssey. Demodocus is singing of the Trojan horse, how Odysseus thought up this ruse, how it led to the sack of Troy. And as Demodocus sings, Homer tells us, Odysseus melted, and from under his eyes the tears ran down, drenching his cheeks. Now here comes the simile. As a woman weeps lying over the body of her dear husband, who fell fighting for her city and people as he tried to beat off the pitiless day from city and children. She sees him dying and gasping for breath and winding her body about him. She cries high and shrill, while the men behind her, hitting her with their spear butts on the back and the shoulders, force her up and lead her away into slavery, to have hard work and sorrow, and her cheeks are racked with pitiful weeping. Such were the pitiful tears Odysseus shed. Now, the reason I say this is a remarkable simile is because of what, in context, it would inevitably bring into the audience's mind. Demodocus has just sung about the Trojan horse, which accomplishes the sack of Troy. Homer then compares Odysseus's weeping to a woman weeping when her city is being sacked. There's no other sack we could think of here other than the sack of Troy. So Odysseus's weeping at hearing Demodocus's song is compared to the weeping of Odysseus's victims, the victims of the Trojan horse, when Troy falls. It's an amazing technique on the bard's part to remind us of both sides of the story. The Trojan horse, from Odysseus's point of view, from the Greeks' point of view, was a magnificent stroke of genius that won the war. But from the Trojans' point of view, it was catastrophe. It was disaster. In this simile, the bard shows us both sides at once and reminds us, as the characters of Hector and Andromache and Priam remind us in the Iliad, the bard reminds us here of the war's cost, of what the Greeks' victory meant to the Trojans. An obvious question, of course, is why is Odysseus crying? Certainly, I don't think he's crying over any kind of grief for the Trojans. He must be crying for some other reason. I think there he's crying mainly through relief, through a kind of recognition that his name, his deeds, his exploits are remembered, that they have survived him, have survived his absence. He has been, to all intents and purposes, dead from the world for all these years since the end of the Trojan War, while Calypso was holding him captive. If he had said to Demodocus, sing about the Trojan horse, and Demodocus had said, sing about what? Or he had said, sing about the horse that Odysseus thought up, and Demodocus said, Odysseus, no, someone else thought up the Trojan horse. Then Odysseus would know that his kleos, his reputation, his fame had not survived his absence. Demodocus's song lets Odysseus know that his kleos is intact, that people do know about his most memorable exploit. One more point before I move on from Demodocus's third song. It's worth considering performance time here. If, as many scholars believe, the Iliad and the Odyssey were designed to be performed over three-day periods, we are just now at about the end of the first day of performance time for the Odyssey. And this is a marvelous place to stop the first day's performance in many ways. One thing, one detail that I always like to bring out at this point is how much emphasis is put on the bard here in Book 8. This is the fullest picture we get of a bard in either Homeric epic. And I like the idea that this beautifully detailed, loving and admiring portrait of a bard comes right at the end of the first day's performance. I particularly like the idea that Odysseus sends Demodocus a tip. He sends him the best cut of meat from the roast pig that they're eating as recompense for Demodocus's skill in singing. This is almost, it seems to me, like Homer getting ready to pass the hat at the end of his own first day of singing, reminding the audience what a really marvelous thing a really good bard is. Another way in which this is very fitting to end the first day of performance is things are coming to such an obvious point of tension in the story right now. Odysseus is about to reveal who he is. He's about to tell the Phaeacians his story. He's about to be sent home to Ithaca. This is a point where you could be quite sure that the audience would come back for the second day of performance. Nobody is going to want to leave it here at this point. As Book 9 begins then, as we move on into Book 9 of the Odyssey, Odysseus again praises Demodocus and then introduces himself at last to the Phaeacians and starts to tell his story. He responds to Alcinous's asking him, who are you? Alcinous sees Odysseus weeping, as we've talked about with this marvelous simile. Alcinous sees Odysseus weeping and asks him, why do you weep when you hear about Troy? By this time, Odysseus has been given ample proof that the Phaiakians are trustworthy, that they are helpful, that they will indeed give him gifts and send him on his way. What he needs to do now is charm them, impress them, so overwhelm them with his story, both its content and its style, that they will give him the best imaginable guest gifts and send him on his way as helpfully as he could possibly hope for. So he starts in on his own first-person narrative of his adventures. He tells them what by this time some at least of them must have guessed. He says, "I am Odysseus, son of Laertes, and my kleos reaches the sky." Up until this moment, up until he heard Demodocus' third song, he would not have been able to say, "My kleos reaches the sky." Now he can. These words stress once again the difference in kleos as it is conceived of in the Iliad, where the main point of kleos, of imperishable fame, is that it lives on after a warrior is dead. And kleos, as it's conceived of in the Odyssey, where the living Odysseus is still very much concerned about his reputation, his fame, what's said about him. Kleos is still important in the Odyssey. It's simply that the focus has changed from kleos as immortality after one is dead to kleos as what people think about one while one is still alive. Odysseus's introduction of himself begins a four-book section of first-person narrative, often called the Great Wanderings. From book 9 through book 12, we're going to listen to Odysseus narrating his own adventures in his own voice, his adventures from the time he left Troy until he arrived on Calypso's island, where he was held prisoner for 7 years. This is the section of the Odyssey in which the most memorable adventures Odysseus has, encounters with mermaids, monsters, sorceresses, and so on, are recounted. And it's also a tour de force on the bard's part, a narration in a character's own voice that lasts for 4 hours is no small accomplishment. And it's particularly noteworthy that the bard keeps perfect control through these 4 hours of performance time of what Odysseus could know and what he could not know. The bard never slips. Odysseus never tells us something that requires the narrator's viewpoint. He never tells us something that the narrator Homer could know, we assume, but that the character Odysseus could not. Throughout these 4 books of the Odyssey, Odysseus recounts his adventures in a way that Odysseus would have seen them and could know about them. He begins his narrative with the Greeks' departure from Troy. The first adventures he narrates are straightforward, everyday acts of warfare, sacking one last city that was an ally of the Trojans, getting a little bit more booty before he and his men head home for Ithaca. But very, very quickly, Zeus sends a storm that blows Odysseus and his men off course, and then the story leaves the realm of the everyday and moves into the realm of marvels. And every adventure Odysseus and his men meet presents danger to him and his companions. The first strange adventure they have, the first truly unusual adventure, is their encounter with a group of people called the Lotus Eaters. Now, the Lotus Eaters, unlike most of the adventures Odysseus has, seem benign. They're friendly, they're peaceful. All they do is offer Odysseus and his men flowers of the lotus plant, and when you eat these flowers, you're overwhelmed with forgetfulness, pleasure, sleepiness. You want to do nothing but lie down under a tree and dream all day long. This is a pleasant danger, but it's a danger nevertheless, because many of Odysseus's men don't want to leave the land of the lotus eaters. They want to stay there, eat lotus forever, and never return home to Ithaca. Odysseus has to drag some of them away, literally. The next adventure he recounts, however, is anything but benign. Perhaps the most famous of his adventures in the Odyssey, this next one is Odysseus's encounter with the Cyclops Polyphemus, the one-eyed giant who kills and eats 6 of Odysseus's men and threatens to kill the rest. As I said, the encounter with Polyphemus is perhaps the most famous of all of Odysseus's adventures. Certainly, it's one of the most important. It highlights Xenia, showing Odysseus at his most quick-thinking and motivating all his further troubles through an examination of negative Xenia, as I like to call it, or Xenia as it ought not to work, Xenia being violated and ignored. The episode's importance, the importance of the episode of the Cyclops, Polyphemus, is marked out at its very beginning by Odysseus's repetition of the same lines, the same formulaic lines that he said when he arrived on Scheria. When he is about to go explore the Cyclops island, he leaves 11 of his 12 ships moored on a nearby island. He takes his own ship and the companions from that ship, sails to Polyphemus's island and goes to examine it, find out who lives there, see what things are like there. And he says that he wants the rest of his crew to wait behind while he and his companions go and find out about these people and learn what they are, whether they are savage and violent and without justice or hospitable to strangers and with minds that are godly. Exactly the same words he had said when he landed on Scheria, woke up when Nausicaa and her girls threw the ball into the river and that awoke him. Here, he's wondering again, are these people civilized and Xenia is equated with civilization or are they savage? As he's going to find out to his sorrow, this time they're savage. On Scheria, the first time we hear him say those lines, he receives the best imaginable Xenia. On Polyphemus's island, he receives its exact opposite. Polyphemus obeys none of the protocols of Xenia, none of the rules of proper behavior. In fact, he violates Xenia about as directly as one could possibly imaginably violate it, rather than giving his guests a meal, he has his guests for his meal. He starts out by killing and eating two of Odysseus's men, says he'll eat another two for breakfast, another two for supper the next day, and so on until they're all gone. Now, Odysseus, in his encounter with the Cyclops Polyphemus, is at his quick-thinking, clever best. He has to come up with a scheme to get away from Polyphemus. And he has to come up with a scheme that gets him away from Polyphemus without killing the Cyclops. Why? Because Odysseus and his men are in a cave. The Cyclops is a giant. He's rolled a boulder against the mouth of the cave. If Odysseus simply kills the giant Polyphemus, then he and his men will never escape. They'll starve to death in the cave. So what he needs to do is think of some way to disable the Cyclops, but not kill him, so that when the Cyclops next removes the stone from the door, Odysseus and his men can get out without the Cyclops knowing it. The obvious way to do this is to blind the Cyclops. And this is what Odysseus does. He gets Polyphemus drunk and then blinds him while the Cyclops is sleeping off his drunkenness. Before getting him drunk, Odysseus tells Polyphemus that his name is Utis, a Greek name that sounds very much like the Greek word for nobody. This is a crucial part of the scheme, because when Polyphemus wakes up with his eye poked out, when he wakes up blinded and screaming in pain, he calls out to his neighbors, the other Cyclopes, for help. That's the plural, by the way, one Cyclops, several Cyclopes. Polyphemus calls out to the other Cyclopes for help, and they call back, "Who is hurting you?" Polyphemus says, "Utis is hurting me. Nobody is hurting me." And his fellow Cyclopes say, "Well, if nobody is hurting you, this must be some disease sent by the gods, and you'd better pray to your father Poseidon to help you." Polyphemus is a son of the sea god Poseidon. So the trick has two prongs to it. Blind the Cyclops, tell him your name is nobody, then when he calls for help, his neighbors will not understand what he's saying and will not come to see if they can help him. Once Polyphemus is blinded, Odysseus and his companions escape from the cave by clinging to the bellies of Polyphemus's sheep. Polyphemus rolls the stone away from the door of the cave to let his flock of sheep out to graze. Odysseus and his men cling to their bellies. The blind Cyclops, feeling the backs of the sheep, doesn't know that they're escaping. Now, Odysseus ought, at this point, to be free and clear. And yet, it's this episode of blinding the Cyclops that leads to all his further troubles, because Odysseus cannot resist, either because he wants to ensure the survival of his own Kleos, or because at this instant he gives way to excessive pride. Both interpretations, I think, are possible. Odysseus cannot resist calling back to the Cyclops from onboard ship and telling the Cyclops his name. He calls back and says, "Cyclops, if any mortal man ever asks you who it was that inflicted upon your eye this shameful blinding, tell him that you were blinded by Odysseus, sacker of cities. Laertes is his father, and he makes his home in Ithaca." This statement of who it was who did this to Polyphemus allows Polyphemus to curse Odysseus by name. Polyphemus calls out to his father Poseidon and says, "Grant that Odysseus, sacker of cities, son of Laertes, who makes his home in Ithaca, may never reach that home. But if it is decided that he shall see his own people and come home to his strong-founded house and to his own country, let him come late, in bad case, with the loss of all his companions, in someone else's ship, and find troubles in his household," which, of course, is exactly what will happen to Odysseus. So by telling Polyphemus his name, Odysseus has given Polyphemus the means to curse him. And it's this curse of the Cyclops that motivates all of Odysseus's future wanderings, all of his troubles from this point on out. In our next lecture, we'll continue Odysseus's description of his journey from Troy, and we'll see how Polyphemus's curse takes effect almost immediately.